CNBC's Big January continues with the JPM Healthcare Conference, the Amex Golf Tournament, Inauguration Day, and the World Economic Forum in Davos. Get ahead of the game. Listen to CNBC on the Odyssey app.
It's a Football Friday on Sports Radio 610. Here's Payne and Pendergast.
Sitting in studio, we're watching... Is this First Take, I guess, that's on?
Yes, it is.
Cam Newton, God love him. He's wearing... I don't even know that I can describe what he's wearing. It's a fuchsia-colored corduroy jacket with a felt bow tie with John Lennon-like blue shades and a pink... I think it's pink. Pink cowboy hat. Like, how am I supposed to take that dude serious? And then you've got Ryan Clark, who is wearing the two-tone jacket that he has now made famous, which I don't know why he thinks that looks good.
It's not two-tone. It's like, it's, well, two it's colors. Two-tone, but it's split. Yeah,
yeah,
one
on split.
One side of his torso is one color, the other.
Right.
Like he's a father of... two brothers that are playing on opposite teams or something. You know where you have the jersey?
Yeah.
You wear one Ravens jersey and one Texans jersey? Right.
Right. Like when A.J. Hawk was going to marry Brady Quinn's sister at the Fiesta Bowl, and she wore half A.J. Hawk's jersey, half of Brady Quinn's jersey.
Or Mrs. Watt. Mrs. Watt wore, I think she did that once.
She wore
half Steelers, half Texans, yeah.
I get it, but he's on First Take. I don't quite understand.
That's what you do, that's how you, you peacock a little bit, and you become more identifiable. Like Craig Sager with
that's
his suits
true,
and everything.
Man.
You're like, oh, what a weirdo, why would you do that? And they're like, oh, it's because I know exactly who Craig Sager is.
He's not just
some guy that interviews people. Calvin Murphy in his suit.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, like, Calvin Murphy, like, a lot of kids these days, like, young Rockets fans know that Calvin Murphy was a great player and everything, but for the most part, they know him as that lovable guy in the big suit
after
games. They love that guy. Yeah.
I love those suits. I just don't like that style.
The split style. Right now. Yeah.
Like, who was it?
Who was the former player that was trying to pull off the ascot for a while? Was it Bart Scott? One of them was trying to pull off an ascot as his big identifier.
His identifier.
Yeah. Camp's, that's a tough one to pull off in Houston.
I don't even know what Cam's trying to pull off, but I get, like you said, yay.
Cam can do stuff that's not even, very few human beings could pull off what Cam Newton does with his hats and everything like that. He's like Prince. He's like the athlete's version of Prince. Like, go ahead and try to dress up like Prince in your own life and see how it works out for you.
So we went to Carolina in 2015. My second year on the sidelines. We go to Carolina. It was the year Carolina went 15-1. We were playing in week two. We got smoked in week one by the Chiefs. Not smoked. We didn't play well. And so Brian Hoyer threw an interception to Marcus Peters on the first play of the game. Like, oh, okay. So now we got to go to Carolina. Now, week two, you don't know how great teams are going to be, but knew that Cam was on the rise for sure. Didn't realize he was going to win MVP that year, but either way. So I'm down on one end of the field before the game, and I'm talking to some people. And I look, and I see three of our defensive backs. And I can remember that, but I just knew they were defensive backs. And they were running in one direction. And as soon as they were running in the direction towards the Carolina tunnel.
Uh-huh.
And right when they got to about the 10-yard line, Cam comes bouncing out of the tunnel. And he's got on his Superman Under Armour, like, tight top. He's got his shoes on, all spatted up, headband, music, headphones, and he runs on the field. And I swear to you, our three defensive backs, as Cam goes past him, all three defensive backs turn and look. And I can see the look in their eyes, and I'm like, oh, we're in trouble. Because if you haven't seen Cam Newton, Cam is a legit 6'6", 250. Like, he is legit tight end size.
He's a tank.
He is a monster. And our DBs just looked at him like, we got to face this dude. And I just remember kind of chuckling to myself like, oh, boy, we're in trouble.
It's, you know, it's funny. It's like kind of Derrick Henry. When you see Derrick Henry as a running back, what the hell is that?
Yeah.
And
he plays running back?
Sean talked about when he was at whichever bowl game they were in. Sean was on the field before the game when Derrick Henry was just a freshman. And,
and
he was watching them warm up, and he sees Derrick Henry there with the running backs, and it just doesn't look right.
Yeah,
it doesn't look like it makes any sense at all that this guy's a running back. And it probably must be some experiment. They're not going to keep this guy there. No, he's going to. I'll tell you my personal experience with that. My welcome to the NFL moment was my rookie year watching. We went and played the Cowboys in Dallas. And watching Herschel Walker, who at that point I'm guessing was like 34 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
He returned a few kicks in that game. And it was like, what the hell is that? like, what? I'm watching from the sideline.
Yeah.
And I got kind of nervous. Like, you're saying, like, how do I? Wait, why are his legs moving so fast? Like, I don't, none of this makes any sense. What is that? And that's why, and not to mention, I'm playing against Larry Allen for the first time and everything. There was a lot of, like, hey, wait a minute. Like, this is a different level of genetics here than these other football players I've been going against. What the hell's going on with these guys?
Yeah, when our defensive backs look back at Cam, and then Cam came running by. I understood because Cam went running by me, and I was like, damn. Like, that's a quarterback? Holy cow. And there have been some physically impressive dudes that you see out on a field. Like, when you see Jeffrey Simmons, you just look at him and go, my God. But he's 308 pounds. Like, you've seen 310-pounders.
Tavondre Sweat, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's Tavondre, who's like 370. Yeah. You know?
Wait, how big is Jeffrey Simmons?
Simmons like 310.
Okay, yeah.
And Tavondre is like 370 or so, he thinks. And I think the funniest thing about Tavondre was I saw a playoff game over at Energy Stadium. I just walked in for a little bit before I was about to leave, and it was – I can't remember who they were playing. It was a 4A game, and Huntsville High School was playing. And this kid, number 44, good-looking athlete, moving around, playing defensive end. And so Ryan Broniger, who covers recruiting for Texags, was there. And since I did some stuff for Texags, I was like, hey, Ryan, and he knows the recruiting scene. Like, who's 44? He goes, oh, that's Tavondre. Like, oh, he's good-looking defensive end. He was 255 at the time.
Yeah.
At Huntsville, and that was his junior year.
Yeah.
So, senior year in Huntsville, 4 or 5 years of Texas, whatever it was, he ended up getting up to 375. So, we went to the Senior Bowl last year. I was at the Senior Bowl, and I was lucky enough to get my being with the Texans. I got that on the field. And so, I, of course, go watch offensive O-line, D-line drills. And I was like, I want to just see how big he is. So I get down in the field, and I'm standing literally 3 feet away, and I feel so bad because I'm literally jaw open like, holy bleep, he's enormous. Like, bigger than I even could imagine, 365 pounds. You get an idea of what 365 pounds looks like, and then you get up next to it, and you're like, and then he started running. And I'm like, oh my God, what if that hit you?
Yeah.
I mean, you die. You die. I'm like, just, oh my God.
You know, that's incredible. The thing about Tavondre Sweat this year. I was skeptical just because, man, when he was at Texas, there were times where, like, he just petered out. You know, you could tell, like, okay, you can only carry that much weight around. He's played more snaps and stayed in the game a lot longer than I thought he would. I think it might help him a little bit in the NFL that the tempo is slower.
Yes.
You know, like when you're a big dude and you're lining up and you're facing an offense that's running, you know, running 100 plays a game, it's tough. And you don't have that much rest time when they're up tempo all the time, that you get a little bit more time to breathe and relax and recover in the NFL.
Yeah, that you're exactly right. You do. You get that time, and he's played pretty well. And I mean, he wasn't doing a ton against us, and then he had the sack at the end. It was like, oh boy. I turned the switch for him.
There's times where it's still like, and it runs to the perimeter. He can get out there, but there's also times where you're kind of like, okay, this play is over for him. You know, like
I'm done.
He can do it every now and then, but yeah, there's a little bit of like, okay, yeah, he's not. I get it.
Yeah, I remember there were two plays. The first two plays of one-on-ones. The very first play, They were doing a run block one-on-one. And he had this poor center snatched up. I mean, this guy's trying to drive his feet.
Yeah.
And he's like got him snatched with his right hand up, literally up in the air. Like he's almost like bicycling his feet because they're not even on the ground. And then the next play, Bo Limmer from Arkansas just drove him into the turf and everybody went nuts. It was like an and one game where somebody dunked on somebody else and everybody's running around all like, ooh. And I mean, he just got just drilled. But
the thing about,
couldn't block him the rest of the week.
The thing that was good about it, to correct me if I'm wrong, but if I remember from just going back, because I was intrigued, I first kind of like started to pay attention when I saw those clips.
Yeah.
And I went and watched some of his games. And if I remember correctly, he used his hands really well.
Yeah.
Actually, I thought that about all the Texas defensive linemen that year, because I know that defensive line coach that went to LSU, like they were coached really well. Yeah. They used their hands well and everything. And it might sound like no big deal, but there are a lot of guys, like Ed Oliver was a guy that needed to learn how to use his hands properly when he got to the NFL.
Yep.
And it took Ed maybe like 3 years to get it.
Yep.
So if you can get a big guy who already has demonstrated that he's got that technique and everything, it makes it feel like a much safer draft pick. Even though he's got weight issues and all that, it just, you can tell, okay, the guy's 360 and he knows how to use his hands. He's going to have some success.
If you've got an athlete, understands how to use his hands, you know this more than anybody, so this is more for the listeners, but when you hear draft dudes like, well, me and some others, talk about, oh, this defensive lineman can use his hands, those guys are typically pretty successful early on.
Yeah.
And stay that way, as long as they don't get fat, out of shape, all that kind of stuff. The guys you worry about are the guys that are just athletic, and they just blow and go up the field, and that's how they end up making their plays, because they're just that much more athletic than college linemen. But when they're forced to use their hands, and I've talked to so many guys over the years, Khalil Davis, I talked to a lot about this.
Yeah.
And Khalil, last year, he was like, coach is always on me about using my hands. And he got better at it throughout the year, using his hands. And you could really see it by the time they got to the playoff game about how effective he was just by learning what you do with these two things. Like, what do you do with these? And if you can learn it, you got a pretty good opportunity.
He had a play, it was on one of their primetime games a few weeks ago. It was beautiful because he was rushing the tackle, he anticipated the chip block, and it was almost like he was a martial artist. He like clubbed the tackle's hands and then like turned his hips, and the chip missed him completely. And then he got his hand on the quarterback's hand as he was trying to throw the ball. And it was like the most efficient pass rush, broken up pass I've ever seen in my life. And it was like, that's like now you look at him, he's at the end of his NFL career and he's just become a master at all. He's a kung fu master when it comes to that.
Yeah, kung fu master. Colin's producing today. Colin, what's up?
Yeah. So y'all remember the whole thing about the size of Kenny Pickett's hands?
Yeah.
Now, does that really matter for O linemen and D linemen, like, is that looked into enough? I mean, Kenny Pickett was kind of an outlier. I mean, everyone made jokes about it. Like, just having the internet was just having its way with it. But does that matter when it comes to the trenches?
I think that so like on a functional side of things, I'll put it the sum total of it. I think football coaches and scouts and other players, just like anybody in random life is, when you meet a person that's got a gigantic paw and they shake your hand, you're like, oh, this is a full-grown man here. There's a certain level of – but I think on the football side of it – and, John, you know the personnel side of it way better than I do. I mean, in general, like – and I'm sure there's exceptions to the rule. The guys that have huge hands – also just tend to have really big frames.
Yep.
And it looks like they're naturally at, like, the ideal is a guy who almost like wakes up in the morning naturally without ever having lifted weights. He's 310 pounds, because those guys just, it feels like they're sturdier. JJ Watt's that way.
Yep.
When you meet JJ Watt in person, you realize like, oh, this guy, JJ could carry 40 more pounds comfortably. His frame is just that big. And I don't know how much he actually, it's not like you're banking on just that one trait, but it tends to go along with a lot of other favorable traits.
Yeah, there, and it escapes me now. There was a lineman and had like small, like really small hands. I was shocked when I found out, like, wait, he's got size 8.5-inch hands. That's the weirdest thing I've ever seen, because he was really good with his hands. I mean, really strong. But the guys that I think can be like Aaron Donald had almost 10-inch hands. Like, that's big. Now, DeForest Buckner's the biggest I've ever seen, like 11-inch hands, and he knows how to use them now. But Aaron Donald's hands were so good. He's 10 inches, you know, but he was only 6 foot, 285. I don't think Ed Oliver had big hands, but Ed was so quick. But now he's starting to learn. And that's the other thing, too. I know people have talked about, well, you know, we beat the Bills, or I've said this. Well, they didn't play Ed Oliver that day either. And Ed Oliver has been an absolute nightmare for people on the inside. And that's one of the reasons the Bills' defense has had some moments where they've not given up 50, they're only giving up 40 because Ed has played. But I think some of that gets kind of overblown a little bit with hand size and all that. But, you know, Jared Goff had tiny hands, and he fumbles the ball a little bit. So it's part of it. But especially to me, the guys on the inside, whether they're playing offense, defensive line, it's a matter of just how strong they are. Because you can have 11-inch hands, but if they're just weak and flimsy, then who gives
it? It is one of those things that, like, it's kind of like the last chain on, like, when we talk about using your hands as a defensive lineman, it's really more on it's how you use your arms in general.
Yeah.
Now, if you have big hands, you know, like, in theory, you should also have a stronger grip and everything.
Yes.
Which is a huge part
grip
of it.
Grip strength.
Yeah, but I should maybe explain that more sometimes. We talk about hands, it's like the boxing element, the martial arts element of swiping and clubbing and locking out, all that stuff. It's just how you're attacking with your upper body more so than anything else.
Yeah, like absolutely.
The other is in terms of big hands and times where I felt like a little child was when I met J.R. Richard for the first time.
Oh, yeah.
So for the kids, Astros pitcher, great pitcher from back in the 80s. But he was famously, how many baseballs could
he hold? Seven, I think.
Seven baseballs.
I remember that. Yeah, absolutely. He had Matt. I'll tell you, he's got the strongest hands is Adrian Peterson. That dude could, like, if you missed the handshake, he'd crush your fingers. Like,
you know what? Okay.
Crush them.
This is my issue with Adrian. That's exactly. I think he tried to make you miss the handshake,
probably so.
Because I'd heard about his handshake the first time I met Adrian Peterson, or not Adrian Peterson, it was Adrian Peterson, sorry. First time I met him, I went to shake his hand, and I had forgotten all about how he's got a strong handshake and everything, and he did the old he squeezed my four fingers.
Oh.
And I'm like, well, all right, that's kind of cheating, man. Like, we were at a charity event, I wasn't gonna ask him for another go round of it. Yeah. But like, that's not genuinely a strong handshake. That's an illegal cut block right there.
Yeah, that's an illegal cut block. He jumped the snap. That's what he did. He jumped the snap as an edge rusher. Okay, we didn't talk about Deontay Johnson in this segment, but we will. I promise. We'll talk about Deontay Johnson next.
It's a Football Friday on Sports Radio 610. Here's Payne and Pendergast.
Wrong again, big guy, but you didn't know. John Harris sitting in for Sean Pendergast along with my man Seth Payne. Hey, Seth, I kind of screwed up in a way, and then I didn't in another way. And I don't know, maybe I wouldn't have been allowed anyways, but you guys do the Circle of Swarm on Fridays, do you not?
Yeah, we did it. We ended up doing it on Tuesday.
Oh, you did it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How do you feel about, wait, is it in the rundown sheet which you went with? Because I didn't get a chance to hear it. So here we go.
No, is it in there still?
Okay, here we go. Week 17, Circle of Swarm. Let's see how we feel about the Circle of Swarm you came up with. Now, I don't know which guys you had, but you had Henry Toa,
mm-hmm.
Nico Collins, Joe Mixon, Daniil Hunter, Christian Harris, Derek Stingley. Defense, offense, offense, defense, defense,
it's,
defense.
You know what? I mean, this is what's hard in evaluating a Circle of Swarm member. It's a high standard to get in there.
And
it's been more heavily weighted to the offense this year, except that Nico and Joe Mixon have made it on there just through their personal heroics a lot of the time.
Yeah.
The defense just, they flat out didn't play well. You know, there's things that they did and did not do. And I think there are times where the linebacking core in general, the defensive line, their reads were not quick enough or not accurate enough. whenever you get run on for how many yards was it? Was it 250 yards they were running?
259, I believe.
That's a lot of yards. That's the worst feeling in the world. Getting run on like that is just the worst. I still feel good about all those guys individually. I think with Danielle Hunter, there's times during the game when you're playing a zone read team where there's times where you're not asking the defensive ends to actually read. They're either instructed on this play, you're going to go for the quarterback alone, or you're going to tackle the ball carrier, whatever it might be. So there were times like that in that game. But there were also other times where, okay, this was a genuine read, or you had certain responsibilities in this play, and the defensive ends didn't do a great job of it. And I think also the linebackers didn't always do a great job of executing that plan either. There's too many times where it's one thing when the defensive end doesn't make the right read, but then when all the linebackers are covered up by offensive linemen 5 yards downfield, that's on them too at that point. So who should I feel good about after that game? If we had to do just a one MVP in a really disappointing football game, is it Kamari Lassiter? Kamari Lassiter? I mean, the Ravens didn't even really try to pass the ball that much.
No.
And Kamari's the only guy who scored points in the game. So maybe it's Kamari Lassiter.
We've played the Ravens three times since 2023. Opening week 2023, playoff game 2023, that game the other day, Christmas Day. We have 4 field goals against them. 4. Like, that's it.
That's the sum total of the production.
That's right, because Steven Sims had a kick return, a punt return touchdown, and Kamari had the 2-point, he had the 2-point safety, which was a hell of a play. And here's the thing about playing the Ravens, Seth, and you know this, and we talked about this a little bit earlier in the show. They're a tough team to prepare for in a short week because they do some different things.
Yeah.
The things that the Texans run defense sees a lot, duo, outside zone, those kind of things.
Yeah.
I know it's going to sound weird, but they actually handled those okay.
Yeah.
The things they don't see every week, the wham crunch, the traps, Lamar pulling it and running it, those are the ones that really gave them a lot of issue.
Yeah.
So there's a part of me that's like, okay, I'm not going to panic. But then again, if you go where you want to go, you're going to see that again. So you got to fix it. You got to fix it. 251 rush yards for the Ravens the other day.
So what do you make of Daniil's comment in the postgame where he said, you know, they need to game plan better next time? And a lot of people looked at that as a criticism of either D'Amico or Bobby Slowick or whomever else it might be. I understand taking it that way. My biggest thing is Daniil's not really that kind of guy that would, you know, is going to try to send a message or criticize a coach or anything. I feel like what he probably meant is that they need to prepare better in general as a team, like for a team like the Ravens, that they just didn't either execute the game plan well enough or they didn't just, like, I don't think he was trying to put the blame on the coaches. I think it was just kind of the way it came out as he was talking about it. And I'm not saying that it's not accurate that, like, they should have, the game plan better, have a different approach, whatever. 100 million things needed to be better with that game. It's just that Daniil's never struck me as the kind of guy that's going to try to send a message like that.
Yeah, I don't think he was trying. I think you're right. When I heard it versus when you read it versus listening to it, it sounded different. It sounds much different because when you see, I saw it in print first and I just was like, oh no. Then I heard it and I was like, oh no, he's
kind of just saying it like,
yeah,
coming up with a list in his head of things to do differently or whatever.
Right, absolutely. And I do think the Baltimore Ravens take a different type of approach to stop them. You do need to game plan differently for a team like the Baltimore Ravens. You absolutely do.
We saw, you know, like the Pittsburgh game, where that was a good, when Pittsburgh played Baltimore, it was actually a really good game for the first three quarters.
Yeah, very much.
And one of the things that happened in that game was the very first drive the Ravens had, they didn't end up scoring, but they were running right down Pittsburgh's throat.
Downhill.
Really, for the first couple series. And Pittsburgh was trying to play it clean. They were trying to have their defensive ends read and do all that, and they were getting destroyed. So at some point, if you're the Steelers, you're like, all right, well, we got to load up the box. We got to blitz. We got to do whatever it takes to try to stop this. That's the, you know, it's a choose your poison element to play in the Ravens. You know, and D'Amico went to a five-man front, and yep. It's like that didn't work. It just, that's a part where I think when you play the Ravens, unless you are as good as them, you got to kind of take the same approach D'Amico did last year in the playoffs, which, all right, look, you know what? We're going to blitz.
Yep.
And it only worked for a half, but at least it worked for a little while. But you're going to selectively, like, we're going to have to blitz. We're going to have to be aggressive. We got to take our chances with the pass game.
Yeah, I think exactly. And, you know, Mark talked about it during the broadcast, and we talked about it yesterday on air and off air about Derrick Henry. Like, you slowed Derrick Henry down to a point in 2023 with the Titans where I think he had 9 yards in the first game. He had 42 in the second. He had 51 total yards.
Yeah.
But he was also behind a god-awful Titans offensive line that was not running a great scheme for them. And yeah. Will Levis can't hurt you.
Right.
Lamar Jackson can. So yeah. It's sort of a lot of things. And plus the Ravens offensive line, although individually not great, together they work really, really well. So yeah. He had that. And then the Ravens scheme where they could run some of those gap runs. They could run some of those traps and whams. That's just kind of the kryptonite for this particular defense. So you do have to plan a different way for that. And you probably need more time to be able to do that than 4 days.
You know, that was what was frustrating to me, was that we've seen other teams this year have some success at times by taking advantage of the Texans' defensive line's aggressiveness. Mm-hmm. You know, they get upfield really hard and fast, and because of that, you're susceptible to traps and yep. whams and things like that.
Yep.
Look, it wouldn't have made a difference in the game, but I do think that's one of those elements where Foley Fatakasi, I think, has a better...
Foley.
They're not going to win the game just because of that, but right. Foley's a guy that kind of understands how to play both ways.
Right.
There's times where, yes, pin your ears back and go, but as a defensive lineman, when you're in a scheme like that, it's the one big asterisk. It's that, yes, get off the line. Don't even worry about just play the run on the way to the right. quarterback. That's all great, unless you read that it might be a trap
yep.
or it might be a wham play. And that's hard to do. It's because you got to do it in your first step.
Yep.
You're like, wait a second, everything's too easy. I got to turn and look, you know? And
yeah.
it's hard. It's hard for it's hard to pull off that little counterbalance. But the fact that the Ravens were able to do it over and over and over again, I was surprised that they didn't adjust to it faster than they did.
Yeah, the Ravens, and they'll do some different things. Like, they'll give you some false pull keys.
Yeah.
And they'll set you up with that, and then bang. But those guys get out. I mean, Falele at right guard earlier in the year, he was a mess, but now he's kind of caught on, and they run a scheme that he can play in, and he's 380 pounds. Like, he's
yeah.
enormous, and so he can push guys around just by getting his hands on guys. So to pay off on the tease, Deontay Johnson, your thoughts about bringing Deontay Johnson in? I thought your tweet on Saturday or Sunday of last week after Tank was hurt, it was not a lot to laugh about, but when I saw your tweet about Deontay Johnson, I chuckled.
Oh, but I said, basically I did a transcript of my day, and it was 11:50 a.m. Why the hell would you want Deontay Johnson? Hell no. 6 p.m.
Yeah.
I've been calling him Swarm Johnson for years. I've always been in his, bring him in. Bring him in. I think it's low risk, high potential reward. It's just, if it works out for a few games and if he can keep from being disgruntled for at least two more football games, then it might have a high upside. He's got a level of athleticism to him that you don't really have on the roster other than Nico Collins right now. So I like that. Just even if he ends up being a decoy, and maybe he gets disgruntled about it, fine. It's one game. Yeah. Like, oh, are you sad that you were a decoy? We'll see you later.
Yeah, I mean, that's what a lot of people have said. Like, hey, you just, if it doesn't work, you just cut bait. You move on. So
it's give him pep talks all week about how he's
going
to be the guy this week. Get him out there running like a demon, running like a banshee, the downfield, crossers, everything. And then if he gets upset, you cut him at halftime. but, he serves a purpose for as long as he can.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe maybe he pulls off Devondre Campbell. I don't know. We'll find out. If it does, it's one game. If whatever.
For all of Deontay Johnson's issues, I still like, if I had to choose between bringing Odell Beckham Jr. in or Deontay Johnson.
Yeah, they did the right
because
thing.
It's just a couple weeks, and because like Odell Beckham Jr. is just not the same guy that he used to be. Yep. I would hands down Deontay Johnson. Just like it's a complete wild card, and maybe it works.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. No doubt. That Deontay Johnson would have been the way I go because Odell Beckham Jr.
It's a Football Friday on Sports Radio 610. Live from the Twin Peaks Studios, here's Payne and Pendergast.
It is not Payne and Pendergast. It is Payne, Seth Payne, 10-year NFL defensive lineman and Ivy Leaguer, which is very important because another Ivy Leaguer is sitting here as well. That's me, John Harris. I was thinking about Ivy Leaguers. We got a few over in the building. Matt Burke is one of them. So Matt's always giving me grief when Dartmouth beats Brown like they did at the end of the year. And his soccer team is Liverpool minus Manchester City. And Liverpool beat Man City the other day. So Burke's like, I don't even know how I could talk to you because your teams are just always losing, John. I'm like, thanks, Matt. That's exactly what I needed. We got a lot of things that are happening this week. Got a lot of bowl games. Got a bowl game between USC and A&M in Las Vegas. And this little breakdown, I'll do one on my footballtakeover.com. The bottom, they put famous alumni for both schools. And I find it fascinating. USC's famous alumni, Will Ferrell, CEO Prestige Worldwide, Neil Armstrong, fake moon landing. I'm reading what they said, not what I said. Jerry Buss, yeah. Lakers owner. Mark McGrath, Sugar Ray. Is Mark McGrath at a point where he should be listed as famous alumni at USC?
Oh, yeah, I think so. Because he does, doesn't he do entertainment news? Isn't he
might on, do that he, now, yeah.
I think he's on E! Network or something.
I think he is. George Lucas invented Star Trek, which I think was Star Wars, but either way. Famous Aggie alumni, Johnny Manziel, as they put here, a.k.a. Johnny 8-Ball.
That's not on the network press release.
No,
right? Okay.
Alex Caruso, aka LeBald James. That's pretty funny. Dude Perfect, aka Jeff Curry. That's good. Dan Campbell, noted caffeine addict. Billy Lucci, one Creed fan and 69th man. And the last one is Francis Turner, invented U.S. highway systems.
Wait, now that's on Wikipedia?
No, this is on, I don't know what this is. Somebody just posted this on Twitter.
Oh, okay.
Chris Marler, okay. Bowl season continues. Here's your bowl breakdown. Facts and traditions for USC. Alumni nominated for an Oscar for 95 straight years. More Heisman winners than any school with 8. More Heisman murderers than anyone with 1. So yeah, this is kind of a tongue-in-cheek breakdown, but funny nonetheless. So
that how have you been enjoying the everything, not just the playoffs but the bowl season and everything else?
Bowl season last night in particular was great. The bowls have been really good. The playoff game stunk, and I was a little mad that our game was Saturday because I was going to miss basically the entire playoffs, but it's fine. I'm glad they did the games on campus. They had great energy. It just weren't great games. And I know there's a lot of talk about, well, SMU should have been in Indiana, all that kind of stuff. Here's what I would say to these people. And I say this a lot. Oh, Alabama should have gotten in. Why? They're the best team. Why? Well, because it's Alabama. Well, no, Alabama's got more talent that will go to the NFL. They're more talented than SMU. But a team implies that you play well throughout the year, double-digit wins, and you don't have some of the losses Alabama had. So is Alabama better if you could put Alabama on a neutral field with SMU? Is Alabama better? Probably. But the talent has to play well, and I don't think at Alabama the talent played well this year. I didn't think Alabama deserved to be in the 12. But, you know, SMU, Indiana didn't make that case for themselves either, so I don't know. Eventually it will. Eventually it'll even out. Eventually there'll be 12 teams that are, you know, on par with one another. I'm excited about this round of games in the playoffs, Seth. I think Texas beats up ASU. I think that I think Boise State with Genty is going to be fun against Penn State. That'll be a fun Fiesta Bowl. And I think the Rose Bowl is going to be the best game that we've seen in Oregon and Ohio State. That's going to be fantastic.
You know what I'd like to – you know what would be interesting is I don't know how this could play out in college football because it's way more political and everything, but like the NCAA wrestling tournament to get invited to the – or to make it to the national championship, they just flat out – I don't know how they determine the strength of the conferences, but it's already preset based on like how that conference has done
right.
previously, like how many guys they have who are All-Americans or whatever. So – the conference gets a certain number of
bids and
wrestlers at each weight class that go. So, like the big, I don't know, like the Big Ten might they're the guys who finish in the top three of the Big Ten tournament go to the national championship or to the national tournament. Whereas, like the winner of the Ivy League, like you only get the winner, like the winner at each weight class.
Yeah, like the NCAA basketball tournament, you get a one bid league, you're a three bid league. All
yeah. So, like, I mean, it just people would get too pissy about it, but there's part of it that makes sense. Where, like, all right, yeah, let's just call it what it is and say. The SEC gets the top three teams are gonna go to the playoffs. Yeah. Some of the lesser conferences, only go one. So that it would be we will never stop arguing about how to do it. But that part of it appeals to me just because it takes all the human part out of it.
Right.
Like it takes out the playoff committee and everything else like that. And it's just like it's set. There's a path to get into the national championship playoffs, and that's how it's going to be.
And one of the things the committee ends up getting in trouble with is they do rankings every single week over the last half of the year. So all of a sudden they have rankings where Indiana's 9 and they don't play on championship weekend. So they've been 9 all along. So all of a sudden at the end of the year, you're going to make that declaration of, well, no, Indiana's not in the top 12. Well, wait a second. You had them 9 the entire year when you were doing these rankings. So there's something inherently different about that. I don't know if they need to bring back like a BCS-style formula and then rank them that way. I think the other thing I would do, and I want them, if they're going to play championship, and I think championship, being a champion of a conference is a big deal, but I don't know that you can have a situation where Texas – is runner-up in the SEC, and it's like a two-touchdown favorite against a team that got a bye. Like, that shouldn't happen. That there's something inherently wrong with that, but I love the on-campus thing. I wish they would do it for two rounds because I'd like to give the teams that get a bye the opportunity to play at home because I think the energy was fantastic for these games, even though the game sucked. There was an energy. We watched the Indiana Notre Dame game. We were in a Yard House, a restaurant in Kansas City, and you could just feel like there's no. We didn't have any of the sound. We're just watching it. We're like, man, you just could feel the energy of that game. Either it was a blowout, not a great game. So I wish they would let the second round go on campus as well. But then you're fighting the bowls, and I don't know the bowls.
I get in trouble at the Yard House, man.
There's you do? Too much.
I go to any place that's got like when they've got. Like so many different beers on tap.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I am a sucker for it because I want to sample everything. Oh, if I'm in a place where I can get a flight of beers, and you're like, oh, this is just a tiny little, glass of beer. Certainly, I can have 29 of these in 10 minutes, and it'll be no big deal. Like the flying saucer, I'm like that too. You somehow feel sophisticated because of it. You're like, oh yes, I can taste the oakiness of the barrel in this one. Sure.
That's right.
Yeah,
and then you said after 29 of them, at least
I haven't been able to feel my face since 5 p.m. But sure, yeah, I'm a connoisseur.
We're not a big drinking crowd when we go on the road. Mark and I in particular, but some of the other guys will imbibe. Not a flight, they won't do that. But they might get some fancy drink or something like that. But it was good. It was a good Yard House. It was packed because Justin Timberlake was apparently playing across the street at some concert hall or whatever. So people were all excited. They got their Yard House and then went over to watch Justin Timberlake. And all we wanted to do was watch Indiana Notre Dame. So we were a little bit out of place for that one. But going to Nashville, man, we got a lot of stuff going on. I mentioned A&M, USC. That I think is tomorrow. Got Baylor LSU Kinders Texas Bowl. I'll be calling that one with Brett Dolan on Sports Radio 610. Looking forward to that. That's going to be a hell of a football game. Really looking forward to that. That will be New Year's Eve day at 2:30, which I thought I broke the news to my wife about that, Seth, but apparently I had not. So when I informed her last night that I was doing that, That was met with some silence and some stares.
Ah, get her something nice with your check.
I know. I'm definitely going to have to do that. Into studio.
Oh, okay.
Walks one Adam Spillane as he's trying to pull out some headphones and try and talk on a microphone. Adam, I got to ask you this. I just saw this news a little while ago on Houston Chronicle, HoustonChronicle.com, Chronicle, however you get it. I just saw it on Twitter. Jonathan Fagan leaving the Chronicle.
Yeah. This is his last game tonight.
Wow.
It sucks.
That's
sad.
That's wild. Because I know you're around. Yeah. It's like with us, the Texans. You're around kind of the Texans media. Mm-hmm. You're around both Rockets and Astros a lot. It's going to be strange to not see a face. Like for us, it was Berman. Like Berman being like, whoa, where's Berman? This is wild.
Even McLean, too. I mean, McLean is out, but not all the way out. But it's going to, because it's going to be, I think Jonathan has been at every game. Maybe not every game this year. I think he's maybe missed a couple. But it's going to go from being like at 95% of the games to now none of the games in a hurry. Just like
I'll tell you what, too, and I think Jonathan too. I've always appreciated Jonathan because, because he knows how to write a recap of a game, which sounds simple enough.
Well, you don't see it that much anymore.
No, these days anymore. A lot of the younger writers, especially for some reason, they start jumping around all over the place chronologically. And they'll leap in with midway through the third quarter, they took and then they jump back to but previously in the first quarter, Jonathan's just, he's an old school journalist, writer who knows how to tell a story. I always appreciate that. So I'll miss being able to just open up the website and see his recap of games.
And he sees everything on the floor too.
Yeah.
He'll talk about, this ref wouldn't call anything today. The other ref had to bail her out. He'll talk about stuff like that. So on days when you have to sit by him, I better pay attention today because he's going to come at me with some stuff.
No more Fagan at the Chronicle. No more McLean at the Chronicle. I mean, Jonathan Alexander has been doing Friday interviews with us with the Chronicle. He's been great. But still, it's like when you have those people that you're so used to reading, that you sit by, that you talk ball with as you're watching the game. I mean, just reminds me I'm getting old.
And you mentioned Berman. I mean, that's all within years of each other. Like, it's the end of an era in this market when you think about it.
Press conference is going to be going sideways, and then Berman could kind of, bring it back on track with a question, totally out of the blue. And just get everything back on track in a press conference. And there are times that I feel like I miss Berman.
Who's the elder statesman now of Houston sports media with Fagan gone?
I don't know if she would want me to say this, but it might be Christy Reakin.
I was thinking
she's been around the longest, I think.
I knew you were going to go there.
I was thinking Christy too.
Yeah,
but I am. But she's not even close to the same age bracket. Though,
I guess Randy. Right? Yeah. You know what, McAvoy?
Yeah,
McAvoy is he?
Randy Mack.
Okay, I feel like both these people. I feel nothing in broadcasting.
Not
people talking about who's the oldest.
Been around for a little bit. Right. I mean, I've been here since 2007. That's 17 years.
Well,
and I feel like a young buck.
You and I both feel like, no, they're young. And then you realize oh, wait a second, I'm getting up there, aren't I?
I'm old.
Oh, okay, yeah, all right. There's not that many. our version of young is not quite the standard version.
I mean, no. Kim Davis would probably be a good choice because she's been here and
she's
the Oilers.
Kim's fantastic. I love Kim.
Yeah.
I absolutely, whenever she's out of practice, she is just such, I love her. I think she's absolutely fantastic. I think there are a lot of young media members that could learn from just her, the questions she asks, I think are really good at press conferences. So the questions you two jokers ask at press conferences are really good. Ab Spillane and Sean Bajani.
Thank you, man.
Nice to see you boys. I didn't know who we were going to see today when we got to 10 a.m., but nice.
I walked in a little late. Why are we talking about this? Is Jonathan Fagan retiring?
Yeah, yes. You didn't see that today?
Jonathan Fagan, done at the Chronicle.
No, he announced that today?
Yeah.
I'll be damned.
Just announced. The Rockets put something out, too.
Yeah, it's
crazy.
I mean, we've known. He hasn't, said anything to anybody, but we've known about it.
Yeah.
And today they announced it, that this is going to be his last
game.
That
sucks, because I was watching the Q&A with Cam Whitmore last night. We're going to play a little bit of that in our show, because he was fantastic yesterday. And Fagan, was right there. And I thought, boy, Fagan, he's a lot more vocal these days than I remember him being whenever I was covering the Rockets, on the regular about 15 years ago.
Because yesterday's a road game, and basically yesterday it's him and Vanessa are the only ones there, so somebody can ask questions.
Yeah, that was just a passing thought in my mind, and I'm like, boy, Fagan's great, dude. And now he's gone.